Hello, everybody. Charisse here with a very special announcement. I am thrilled to share that RCAT is now an official AIA continuing education provider. With this remarkable distinction, RCAT has launched RCATemy, a continuing education platform for the busy AEC professional. And here's the really exciting part. You can now earn continuing education credits by doing exactly what you are doing right now. That's right, you can now earn AIA credits by listening to select episodes of Detail. Whether you're working around the house, on your commute, or stuck in a waiting room, just listen, take a brief quiz, and your credit will automatically be recorded with AIA. It's really that simple. Plus, bonus points that much of our content qualifies for that elusive HSW credit. And we all know how valuable those are. What more could you ask for? We aim to please. Find out more at rcat.com/continuing-education or follow the link in our show notes. And thank you for tuning in to the RCAT Detailed podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
We really need the industry to provide solutions because, you know, buildings are snowflakes and they're all going to be a little bit different. But this is where I think especially the architectural industry can really step up and figure out how to make interventions in a really historical and beautiful and appropriate way and still be wildfire resistant. Like, we don't actually have the answer to that. We know the materials, we know the details that need to be there, but how do you keep it still mid-century?
I think that's where the collaboration between architects and engineers, like myself, Robin, and RDH, like, we're engineers. We can, you know, provide a solution that's going to be wildfire resistant, but you know, it's coming with that design vision and really collaborating to find an innovative solution that's going to be beautiful and still stand the test of time.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. Incidentally, my guests today are two of my colleagues in my day job at RDH Building Science, Robin Urquhart, Senior Consultant and Building Enclosure Engineer, and Cameron Chorney, Senior Engineer. Robin Urquhart, jokingly, we call his last name his evil Care Bear name, is a Building Enclosure Engineer and Red Seal endorsed carpenter with over 16 years of experience in the architecture, engineering, and construction industry. He specializes in high-performance building design, including net-zero construction, wildfire-resistant enclosures, radon mitigation strategies, and the development of policies and guidelines to advance building science. Robin is also a paid on-call firefighter. As an associate and senior engineer, Cameron Chorney is an integral member of RDH's Building Enclosure Group, leading the development of RDH's Southern California practice. He is experienced in both new building projects, building enclosure assessments, and renewals of existing buildings across the country. He specializes in high-performance building design, including net-zero construction, wildfire-resistant enclosures, climate-resilient enclosure design, and the development of policies and guidelines to advance building science. In this episode, we are straying a bit from our typical format due to recent events to talk about a very real and critical subject, wildfire-resistant construction. But Before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Wildfires are an escalating threat to buildings across North America. Yet strategies for wildfire resilience are still too often absent from building design practices. RDH Building Science is actively working to close that gap, driving innovation in wildfire-resistant construction through hands-on research, rigorous testing, and collaboration with governments, industry partners, and local communities.
The question of am I at risk or you know, I have a forest in my backyard, I think that resonates with a lot of folks. And, you know, I think it's something like 30% of the US population live in wildland urban interface zone, which we'll mention that term, and we'll probably use an acronym of WUI zone throughout this. So really want to start and just define that as a geographical area that is on the edge of a forested area, you know, to more urban land in that interface. And that's looking at the fire severity in that zone. And that comes down to that definition, usually comes down to your local, you know, fire marshal or building code saying that you're in this WUI zone and that you may have some susceptibility to wildland urban interface fires. So that's the first step, is understanding if you are at risk. If you're, you know, in the middle of a big city and not close to any forests, then yeah, probably not in a risk zone. But if you're on the edge, you see a lot of nice forests around, then it is something maybe you should think about. So from understanding if you are at risk, it's then looking at solutions to limit that risk. And this wildfire resistant construction we'll talk about today is a big contributing aspect to that. So it's, you know, we've been doing a lot of research and have understanding on how we can resist these wildfires and the spread from, say, embers to structure ignition. And some of that is defined in certain codes here in California. It's the Chapter 7A of the California Building Code or Residential Code. And it really looks at, you know, materials and assemblies that we can use on our structures to stop fires from starting in the first place related to embers. It comes down to the structure and building enclosure is largely a piece that will resist that. And at RDH, that's what we focus on.
The special things about wildfire, what makes it different than other sort of like some of the other natural disasters, is its total destruction. So the statistic is, and it seems to play out, that if your building is ignited during a wildfire disaster event, there's a 99% chance of total loss, which means if your building starts to catch fire, it's basically gone and all of the contents are gone. And I think that's different. That's a larger impact than a lot of other natural disasters, which may result in partial destruction or damage, you know, hail, high winds, stuff like that. And when you have total destruction, there are things that come along with that that are not covered in, you know, one of our major metrics in North America for a disaster is insurable losses. You know, like the LA fires are going to be probably the largest insurable loss event in US history, which makes it the largest loss event in the world history. When we use statistics like that, we miss a large degree of the impact, which is like missing a year of school, losing your family photo album. Like there's a lot of things in there that are not covered. And I think that's what makes wildfire stand out a lot in people's minds. It's like, if it happens to you, you have a good chance of losing everything, if not your life. It's just that magnitude of destruction, I think, that makes wildfire a little bit different.
To further understand what wildfire-resistant design is, we need to unpack a few terms that detail critical materials and benchmarks. I ask Robin and Cam about these definitions in rapid-fire succession, starting with non-combustible materials.
For all of these terms, they're all within the context of what you expect a normal fire scenario to be. So in the case of a non-combustible material, it means that it doesn't ignite, so it won't catch fire, and it doesn't spread fire. So common non-combustible materials are like concrete, fiber cement, stucco, you know, cementitious products. It doesn't mean that they're totally undamaged after a fire. Concrete loses a tremendous amount of structural integrity when it's exposed to high heat and duration. So it's not that they won't be damaged, it's just that they won't ignite and they won't spread the fire further.
Ignition resistant materials.
That's kind of like the next step, where it's more difficult to ignite and it slowly spreads the fire. So that can be like fire retardant treated wood, some composite products. What you get out of an ignition resistant material is usually something called a flame spread and smoke spread rating. And it's done from a standardized test, but you want to keep those values under a certain threshold to be considered ignition resistant.
Fire resistant ratings.
So fire resistance is an interesting term because it gets used a lot. And so you might say something's fire resistant, and you might mean something a little bit more casual than when we're talking about in fire resistance ratings. Fire resistance rating is a technical term, and it refers to an assembly that maintains its structural integrity and its barrier function over whatever the test duration is. So a good example is a wall. Walls often have fire resistance ratings. And I know for the architecture crowd, this is like, yeah, we already know all about this. But a fire resistance rating is basically, it resists the heat and flame and smoke from the fire side to the protected side. In North America, we mostly, when we're talking about fire resistance ratings, we're talking mostly from the interior. So we're talking about an interior fire resistance rating. The mindset shift that we have to make when we're talking about wildfires, the fires are from the outside. And so our fire resistance ratings have to be from the outside too. It's basically, how long does that assembly perform its function before the fire gets through it?
Yeah. So an architect may see, oh, fire resistance rating, I have this perfect 1 hour roof or floor assembly or wall assembly, but that may just be focusing on from the interior with gypsum or something to resist that. But it's really the next level and shifting that lens to the exterior.
Wildfire resistant barrier.
Yeah. So this one, I think we may have coined it internally at RDH or used it more than other external kind of folks. And this really comes back to the building science and the control layers, the principles of building science, you know, your air barrier, your water resistive barrier, thermal insulation and continuity. So with those key building science and building enclosure control layers, you know, are always saying, okay, if you can draw a continuous line of the air barrier throughout all detail sections, plans of your building, then that's how you get to a continuous air barrier. So it's similar with wildfire. We start with good wildfire resistant assemblies that have these nice ratings we've been talking about, but it's always the details and transitions between those assemblies where things can happen and the vulnerabilities pop up. So it's drawing that continuous line over the exterior of the building and understanding what's providing the wildfire resistance with each, you know, point of that line. And that's essentially what we look at as the wildfire resistant barrier.
And finally, the concept of wildfire versus structure fire.
You know, we see this massive devastation with, you know, the fires that just happened in Palisades and, you know, Eaton and other places. And there's really a timeline and shift from what we would consider a wildfire, you know, ignitions or wildfire resistance. And once we get past and, you know, get to that full structure is on fire, then it starts becoming more of a residential structure fire type situation where the heat and fuel and load of wildfire is much smaller and, you know, passes by a structure much quicker. We're talking a matter of minutes and the temperature's relatively low from embers. But then when a structure catches on fire, you know, then we're talking, you know, hours of that building being on fire and much higher heat and, you know, flame spread. So it's really resisting that initial wildfire load. And then once structure's on fire, it then becomes more of your typical architecture looking at setbacks and how can we resist that large structure to structure spread. And once it gets to that structure-to-structure spread, it really, you know, comes back to wild firefighting availability to get to those structures and put them out before, you know, we start multiplying and spreading across.
One common misconception about wildfires is how they even materialize. As it turns out, embers play the biggest role in wildfire ignition, and the resistance necessary when considering building materials and details in home construction.
The difference between them is sometimes very subtle, and sometimes it's just very obvious. So as we were talking about ignition-resistant materials, they're just harder to catch fire. So if you have a direct flame next to a material, it's either not going to catch fire, non-combustible, or it's going to be a lot more difficult to catch a fire, and that's ignition resistance. Ember resistance, and I think this is, you know, when we're talking about wildfire and structure fire load, the thing that causes the most ignitions from a wildfire is actually the embers ahead of the flame front. And they can spew out, you know, 300 feet in front. Like, that's a large density of embers can be 300 feet in front of the actual fire. And so you don't need a flame right next to your house for your house to catch fire. It can be these embers that land in like leaf litter piles or under your deck where it's really dry, or collect against like a horizontal and vertical interface that's combustible and just generate enough heat. Or they can get through your roof vents. And that's been proven to be a major vulnerability in wildfires, because your roof should be keeping things extremely dry under it. And so it gets into your roof and you might have cellulose insulation there. You might have a lot of extremely dry combustible materials. You might even have leaf litter because your venting system isn't working that well. So ember resistance is actually one of the things that we want to make sure of. It's like the baseline in wildfire urban interfaces. Like, every house should be ember resistant at a minimum, because they are insidious. They are ubiquitous in a wildfire. And they are the things, it's up to 90% of ignitions are caused just by the embers alone. Then heat resistance is a little bit different. It's not something that's really necessarily talked about a lot, but it's the ability of a material or component just to resist the radiant heat, not necessarily catch fire, but something like vinyl plastic, for example. You don't have to apply that much heat to it for it to actually materially change. And so a vinyl window can maybe deform at the frame and the pane can fall out. So nothing was actually ever going to catch fire there. But now all of a sudden you have a big hole in your building, and then all the embers can get in, and then it's game over for you. Or your vinyl siding is going to all warp and fall out. Or your vinyl soffit, this is a major one. It doesn't take a lot of heat, but your vinyl soffit starts to buckle, and then it falls out. And then again, it's a way for the embers to get in. So heat resistance is actually an important concept in all of this, but it's not something that actually gets mentioned that much. And I think that there could be a little bit more emphasis on it. At least in the past 5 wildfire disasters. So I'm thinking about LA. In Canada, Jasper recently, Lytton, an entire town burned down in Canada, Paradise. All of these were actually ember-driven for the most part. The bulk of the fire didn't quite reach the town. Maybe in some areas it did, but it was the embers really spewing ahead of the fire that caused the majority of the ignitions. And then, like Cam was saying, once a house is on fire, well, then you're in a different scenario, because a house can easily catch another house on fire. It's like a domino effect. This happened in Jasper in Canada, talking to the fire chief there. And he said he watched, they had cedar shake roofs in a lot of places, and the roof would catch fire, catch the house on fire. And that house would just catch every other house on fire down the block. And that all started from these little embers, tiny little sparks, you know, landing in something that's really dry, finding a crevice, and then causing, you know, essentially a major disaster.
You know, we love to think, oh, you know, call 911 and tell them our house is on fire and come and put it out. But in reality, in these wildfire situations, just the number of structures that catch on fire becomes out of control at a certain point and just can't get to all of them. So it's really, you know, stopping it before we get to that point is what we're really focused on. And from there, it becomes a different effort.
A key factor in the devastation of wildfires is comprehending how these events escalate to disasters in urban areas, often of unprecedented magnitude, like we've recently seen in Southern California.
There are a lot of wildfires that don't light up buildings. They just exist in the wildland, and they burn, and it's a natural part of our ecology in many forests. And it's not a disaster because nobody's house burned down. It's a disaster when human infrastructure, lives are affected. And it's a disaster, they become disasters, and it's called the wildfire urban disaster sequence. And it's basically just what we were talking about. Like, a vulnerable house catches fire, and it catches another house on fire, and you get an urban conflagration. That's what happened in LA. The houses caught each other on fire. The wildfire was the initial cause, but then you know, the buildings burn themselves down. But why it becomes a disaster is because firefighting resources are overwhelmed pretty quickly. So fire setback distances are based on a response time from your fire department. And to treat a fire, you know, I'm a paid on call firefighter. To treat a fire, you need a truck or two, an engine and a tanker at least, but maybe a couple of engines, just to be able to treat the buildings on either side of the house that's actually on fire. Because you're probably not going to put that house out, but you can stop the other houses from catching on fire. So for a smaller department, even for a larger department, how many houses do you need on fire to completely overwhelm your resources? Well, for a small department, probably two or three. And then you don't have enough engines to kind of deal with everything. So if those embers catch three houses on fire, you're in a very different scenario. You're probably not going to be able to protect the houses on either side. So it becomes a disaster because essentially, because of the density in which we build in the wildland urban interface, the fire resources, firefighting resources, just get overwhelmed in a wildfire event. And then the houses catch each other on fire. And then you're just trying to get people out of there and stop the spread as much as possible.
Valuable guidance on fire-resistant practices and principles can be found in resources from FireWise in the U.S. and FireSmart in Canada, both of which offer practical education for reducing wildfire risk.
FireWise is an organization in the U.S. In Canada, we have FireSmart, very similar. And it's basically recommendations based on the best science of what you can do to protect your property in your house. And it's basically a combination of behavior change, of landscaping practices, and of changes that you can make to the building itself. So you want to, ideally in the FireWise world, you want to be able to landscape out 100 feet from your house. Sort of like pick the extent of your house, the outer perimeter of your house, and then landscape 100 feet out from that. And there's sort of concentric or zones, you know, the immediate zone, the intermediate zone, the extended zone. And you do different things in each of those zones because of the hazard associated with those zones. So right next to your house, which is, you know, 5 feet out from your house, you want it to be basically non-combustible. A gravel apron around there is a really great idea. Because if you have grass and you let it grow too long and an ember lands in there and it catches the grass on fire next to your house, then it's going to maybe catch your house on fire. So it's all about like, what do I need to do that's reasonable to reduce the risk of my building catching fire? And then there's, you know, the actual elements of the building itself that you can mitigate by using things that Cam's already mentioned, Class A roofs, ignition resistant or non-combustible siding, stuff like that. So FireWise is really all about reducing the risk of your building catching fire through, you know, three basic pathways. And you can find a lot of information. It's one of the more like public facing, easy to understand portals for homeowners to understand what they can do about their property.
And that's, you know, a lot of those things you can do are approachable as a homeowner. You know, think of your DIY projects, and then you can go next level beyond and look at the enclosure and home hardening. So it's just a good thing to read up on, if nothing else, and see what you can do before you get beyond things that you may have to involve some other folks with.
One thing that a fire chief said to me recently at a presentation, I thought it was really good. He said, what we often do is we stand in our house and we look outside. You're looking at the forest, right? You go outside and you're like, gosh, those trees are so close to me. And you think, how is that going to catch my house on fire? And he said, what he does now and what he encourages people to do is walk around to the tree side, look at your house, be the fire and say, how am I going to catch you on fire? And everything that you can see as a vulnerability from that side, that's what you want to start fixing. And you want to reduce that load, basically, in the landscaping. You want that to be so that you have to stand pretty far away from your house to be able to see how you're going to catch your own house on fire. And it's just a bit of a little shift in mindset, but it's been really, really valuable to help homeowners understand what the risk for their property is.
The dynamics of competent wildfire resistance adhere not only to your own home, under what is called the, quote, home ignition zone, but also to the proximity to neighbors in an urban community.
The home ignition zone is basically your building and the area around your building, like I was just talking about, sort of this 100-foot, you know, buffer that you want to manage in some degree to reduce the chance of your home catching fire. That's basically it. The problem is that that 100-foot buffer, like how many other properties are in that 100-foot buffer? Like draw, like imagine, you know, you're walking 100 feet out from any direction of your home. Do you run into someone else's property? If you're in a suburban neighborhood, the answer is almost always, yeah, at least one. Like we've done these sort of parcel maps and we've taken concentric circles in your immediate zone, which is 5 feet out from your building. You can really control that. That's basically your property. You get out to the next zone, intermediate, and all of a sudden there's usually five or six properties in that zone. Then you get out to the extended zone, the full extent of 100 feet, and you've got 11, maybe 14 properties in that zone. So you're not mitigating that. Those are your neighbors. Like they would love you to mow their lawn, but you're probably not really spending a lot of time on their property. And that's where community ignition resistance comes in, because you can only do so much, right? And if you fix your property, that's fabulous. But your highly combustible neighbor beside you, if they catch fire, it doesn't really matter what you did that much, because the load from a structure fire is so much higher usually than from a wildfire. And so the things that you did do, well, it doesn't matter, because 10 feet beside you is this house that's on fire, and it's going to undo most of those things. So the idea of community ignition resistance is get everybody to buy in. Like we know that our properties are touching. We know that there's this 100-foot buffer that really, really makes a difference. And it's really based on good science. So get everybody involved, get everybody to change their behavior, mitigate their properties. And then you really do have, you know, a much safer community as a result. Just each person doing it individually, sort of piecemeal, haphazard, it does something, but not nearly on the level of if you get everybody to buy into the program. There's lots of documentation out there for community wildfire protection plans and planning processes. And a lot of communities actually have already developed these wildfire protection plans. So they're starting to think about it on the community level. The thing that we really like in developments, like strata developments, condos, is they actually get to control a large amount of properties. And so we're dealing with a couple of properties in high wildfire areas right now, wildfire hazard areas. And the wonderful thing is they get to do the landscaping, because all those, it's part of a council, and they just stipulate what the landscaping is going to be for all those homes. And then all of a sudden, and that's what happens. And then the risk, the load on the structure itself or multiple structures is significantly reduced. So by the nature of your townhouse development, I mean, that could be a real advantage, because you're actually already part of a community that makes decisions together or can make decisions together. And so you can actually do a lot. It's when you're in, you know, really individual communities that are already established, like in suburbs, and you have a lot of individual properties. That's where it becomes a bit more challenging to get everybody to buy into it. Another idea of community resistance is the building code. So we don't really think about it that way, but that's what it is. It's trying to create community resistance to earthquake, wildfire, you name it, electrical. But it only applies to new buildings or when you actually do like a major upgrade to your building. And so it's great because a new neighborhood, let's say in California where the building, you know, a wildfire code exists, a whole new neighborhood is all going to be relatively wildfire resistant because they have to be. And so there's a lot of community ignition resistance there, but you get existing neighborhoods, a new house is being built, and then it's like what we were talking about before. It's just that one new house that's actually mitigated, and all the other buildings around it and properties are as they have always been.
For those curious to find out whether they live in a wildfire zone, contacting local authorities and requesting maps is invaluable.
You're going to look at your building code to tell you what is required of you in that design and construction. And that's where we'll use California locally as an example. It tells you there to go look at the fire marshal or Cal Fire's website, and they have maps defining the wildfire risk zones or severity zones. And that's really what tells you, do I even need to apply these wildfire resistant construction practices? And we'll, you know, add a little caveat that those maps are always changing, and you know, we talked about ember spread, and you know, so it may not be required, but you know, you may want to look at your home or property and you know, assess what your risk tolerance is or what with climate change will it push it a little bit closer right on the edge of that line. Now it might make sense to look at these measures. So there should be maps out there telling you if you're in a wildfire risk zone.
I think there's two things going on there. One, a wildfire can generate a lot of embers that can, you know, in some cases can be a mile ahead of a fire, especially if you have really high winds. And so that could have been part of the cause of the spread of the wildfire, or why you might see wildfires outside of what you would consider very high hazard severity zones. But in LA, mostly it was structures catching each other on fire. And it was an urban conflagration, it was a city fire, essentially, once those, you know, the houses that were actually in the wildland urban interface, once they caught fire and they caught all the other houses on fire, it spread much further than you would typically think. Outside of the very high hazard severity zone. Like, how do you know what the risk is for your building, right? There are usually state level maps for wildfire risk. In Oregon, there's something really interesting called the Oregon Wildfire Risk Explorer. You can just search it online. A lot of states have similar portals, mapping tools, things like that. You can just add your address and it'll just tell you what your hazard severity is. And that's a really great tool. It's updated constantly. That's a really good way to know, just to get a sense, you know, from what other people think your hazard is. But I also think that there is, you know, a go outside and look methodology as well, which is like, if you can touch a tree next to your house and you know it gets really dry in your neighborhood because you've been living there for a while, then are you in a high hazard zone? Very possibly. And it might not be covered in the map. You know, it's sort of like looking at your phone to tell you what the weather is like. You can go outside and test the weather. You don't always need to rely on, you know, a tool that somebody else has provided. That said, on a macro scale, those maps are extremely important. And they are one of the things that is absolutely necessary to reducing wildfire risk for communities. But I wouldn't take that away from just like really look around at your individual situation and just use your own judgment. Because on the map, you might not be in a high hazard zone, but you could also just be a little bit less risk tolerant. And so you're in a moderate zone, but you still want to do something about it. You know, just because it's the code doesn't mean that you can't do something about it. If you feel like, you know, I just feel uneasy in the summer, it gets really dry around here, and I just want to do a little bit to protect my house. That's a great attitude to have. And it's outside the code and it's outside the maps. It's just like, you know, why not do that?
Practically, I wanted to figure out what preventative measures or materials require direct attention when mitigating the ignition of a home structure. Cam highlights the benefits of roof replacement in existing structures and what materials perform better than others.
Soffits. Do you have a ventilated attic that has soffit vents? You know, there's going to be various levels of interventions, and, you know, putting a screen over soffit vents may be one of the low-hanging fruit, an example of one of the largest contributing factors to structures catching on fire. Simply, you know, installing a metal wire mesh of a certain, you know, diameter holes can drastically reduce the fire risk of your building. So it's really looking at, what do we do in new construction? Great, we, you know, provide wildfire resistant assemblies. That might be a little bit costly and not, you know, make the most sense practically for, you know, say you have a relatively new wall or roof. And I may not go and replace the roof, you know, a couple of years into its service just because you want to get up to wildfire resistance. But when you have to replace the roof down the road, that's a great opportunity to implement wildfire resistant materials and construction. And if your risk tolerance is a little bit lower, then maybe that is an intervention that you might want to put your resources to. So it's really looking at your specific vulnerabilities for your building and looking at how we can address those.
So what's a good roofing material? I mean, that's one thing people on existing homes do all the time, re-roof their house. What would be a good choice for a roofing material?
Yeah, so like with any material, there's various tiers of cost and benefit. You know, you could look at a metal roof or a standing seam metal roof, you know, great from a weathering and durability standpoint, but also highly fire resistant. You know, look at that asphalt shingles. There are certain asphalt shingles that have a wildfire resistant or fire resistant rating associate with them, and, you know, class A roofing materials, underlayments. So their products on kind of all ends of the scale in terms of cost and long-term durability.
Insurance companies can widely vary from state to state in evaluating risk and the incentives of whether coverage is guaranteed or not.
Insurance companies, they want to give you insurance. That's how they make money. They just don't want to pay out again. That's also how they make money. You know, not that there's anything nefarious about it, but they're really interested in you reducing the risk of a disaster happening to your house, especially wildfire, which is a total loss disaster often. And the insurable loss is very high as a result. So there are, in most states, California, Colorado, Texas, Louisiana, even Oregon, there are insurance incentives associated with adopting wildfire-resistant construction or meeting certain program requirements or tiers, whatever. There's, in California specifically, just as an example, there's the Wildfire Prepared Home. It's in a program from the IBHS, the Insurance Institute for Business Home Safety, and it tells you what you should do. And there are a few insurance companies that say, if you meet this standard, the IBHS standard, then we will give you a break on insurance. It could be a break on your deductible. It could be a break on your premium. In some cases, you know, I think you just might be able to get insurance at all. We have in our jurisdiction, insurance companies in Canada, it's a little bit different, but anecdotally are pulling out of regions because they just have no way of being able to ensure that people are wildfire prepared. And it's too much of a risk for them. They want you to insure your house, but they really don't want your house to burn down because then they pay it. And so there are a lot of incentives. There's even maybe just getting insurance at all. But I think there's just your own insurance as well. You know, like if you, whether or not you have insurance, doing these things provides you a level of insurance outside of like the official insurance, where how much does it cost to replace that family photo album? Like, what's the price on that? And there obviously isn't a price.
From an aesthetic standpoint, I was interested in whether fire-resistant design in new structures is often seen as visually unappealing, or if architects have found ways to integrate safety measures without sacrificing originality.
Yeah, I think short answer is no. It doesn't have to be an ugly fortress, and that's why we have brilliant architects in the world, and I'm sure listening to this podcast, it's understanding, you know, those wildfire-resistant assemblies and things you can use, but then applying them in a beautiful way. It doesn't have to be a concrete box or, you know, all metal facade. There's a bunch of different avenues to go down and different palette to use to make this look or be wildfire resistant. And, you know, I think ideally you would, you know, look at a home and not know that it's wildfire resistant construction. And that's, I think, totally achievable. And you can see, you know, unfortunately, some of the examples that survived some of the fires recently, you know, they're beautiful homes and they should be. So definitely there's a way to do it without it being ugly.
New construction, you go to a new neighborhood in California that's built to the code, you can't tell. You honestly can't tell the difference between a house right beside that is not built to the code. Like, they can look really similar. I think it's when you get to like specific architectural styles that it gets a little bit more challenging. And we've talked about this with architects previously. Like, if you've got a home that has, let's say it's a Craftsman or it's like Spanish Revival or something like that, like, what do you have to do to that building to make it wildfire resistant? And are there so many interventions that you have to introduce that it's no longer the architectural style? I think that's what a lot of people struggle with sometimes, because you have these like maybe these like beautiful wood columns or something like that supporting an exposed rafter deck roof. Like, that's gorgeous, but that is a wildfire hazard, to be honest. And so what do you do to mitigate that hazard on some of these buildings? And how do you still maintain the, you know, the historical and architectural integrity of it? And I think, you know, we don't have the answers to all of that. I think that's where we really need the industry to provide solutions because, you know, buildings are snowflakes and they're all going to be a little bit different. But this is where I think especially the architectural industry can really step up and figure out how to make interventions in a really historical and beautiful and appropriate way and still be wildfire resistant. Like, we don't actually have the answer to that. We know the materials, we know the details that need to be there, but how do you keep it still mid-century?
I think that's where the collaboration between architects and engineers, like myself, Robin, and RDH, like, we're engineers. We can, you know, provide a solution that's going to be wildfire resistant, but, you know, it's coming with that design vision and really collaborating to find an innovative solution that's going to be beautiful and still stand the test of time.
Another common misconception about fire resistance measures is their cost, which can vary significantly depending on the project, particularly when comparing retrofitting existing structures to incorporating these measures in new construction.
I think it really depends project by project. I can give like some sort of general numbers, but some things to consider first, like cost more than what? Like just building like the absolute base house, or not even, you know, not even. If you're building in an area that has a wildfire code, then it doesn't cost any more because you just have to do that. That's just what it's going to cost you. How much does it cost more than buildings that we were building 20 years ago, let's say? It's hard to say because we're using data that's old. But let's say when we've done these costing estimates, if you take the cheapest options that are available on the market, building a wildfire-resistant home is going to be about 10 to 15% more expensive. Just because of the mostly material upgrades. You're not using vinyl siding, you're using fiber cement siding. There is a cost increase. There's also a transportation increase sometimes with that too. So yes, you're switching to tempered pane windows. That is going to cost a little bit more than a regular float glass window. But these aren't huge cost increases. And I think depending on your project, you might have been doing that anyway, because you have, say, you want windows that are below, have, you know, the sill is below 18 inches above the ground, which means that it has to be tempered anyway. So you're already there. So what's the cost increase for that window? Absolutely nothing. Maybe you were considering stucco siding anyway. Cost increase? Nothing again. So it really depends on the project. And I think people get scared from the costs because they're thinking about what is the absolute cheapest thing I could have ever done. But you were never actually going to do that. You were always going to choose like more expensive options in some regard. So I think that the costing thing can be a little bit of a red herring. But I would say if we're going to be totally honest about it, yes, it does cost a little bit more to build wildfire resistant for new construction. When you're talking about retrofitting a house to make it wildfire resistant, it's a lot more expensive, unless you're already redoing your roof. But if you only redo it for wildfire, then yeah, you're into $40,000 or $50,000 right away. So it really is like the time to do it is in new construction. And, you know, do what you can with your existing building. But the time to introduce major wildfire upgrades is when you have to redo a major component of your building. Don't just build back what you had. Build it enhanced, because you're going to save so much more money that way. And it depends on the area too. Like we did, there's a study in Canada that looked at the cost-benefit ratio of new construction adopting wildfire versus not. And then the likelihood, so like an actual assessed risk, it doesn't assess every building's going to burn down, so what's the cost-benefit ratio? That would make no sense. But it assesses, well, what's the likelihood of any of these buildings burning down, given historical facts and what we think is going to happen in the future? It's trying to be very realistic. They weren't trying to paint like a morbid picture. And the average across Canada was a 4-to-1 cost-benefit ratio, which means that for every dollar you put in, you get $4 back out just by adopting wildfire-resistant construction. In a lot of areas in Canada, it was 30-to-1. So when you think about it on a macro scale, it almost always pays back. There was no area in Canada that was lower, because when a house does catch fire, the losses are so high. And it means that like so many houses could have mitigated. So it's an important element to the cost conversation. It's the cost of what does it cost to build it, but it's the cost of what's the cost if you don't.
To better navigate these costs, Pinpointing specific vulnerabilities is essential.
You know, starting with good assemblies, that class A roof, 1-2 hour rated wall assemblies. But then, yeah, we start looking at how do structures catch on fire. We talked about embers being, you know, the major source. So looking at vents and other penetrations where those embers can accumulate, you know, so not having any big gaps or cracks, you know, in any element of the building enclosure where embers can get in and kind of collect, and then that's starting to provide a heat source to ignite. Then looking at windows, Robin mentioned the example of vinyl windows. So technically, you know, they're acceptable by code in California and other places, but you know, we need to do certain things like put reinforcing in those vinyl windows if we want to use them so that that pane doesn't fall out, or looking at, you know, more resistant materials like aluminum or, you know, some other metal clad type approaches. So that's, you know, a couple of the big ones. And then you look at decks, you know, wood decks. So you have a nice, beautiful wood deck that connects to your, you know, back patio door. Yeah, it's a huge amount of fuel there that if we don't, you know, do it in a resistant way, could then contribute to that source for a larger structure fire. You know, some other things, say on the foundation, maybe you require insulation on the exterior for your building code in your part of the country. You know, those are usually plastic materials. So protecting any flammable materials comes back to the assemblies and wildfire resistant materials as well. And then, you know, maybe we look at active suppression, you know, beyond structure. Maybe we have sprinklers or some, you know, water source that we can draw from and maybe provide some active fire protection during an event in the worst case.
What we have with our existing building stock, some of the vulnerabilities that we see, they're sort of just baked into how we used to build, you know, in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. Like, we love wood siding, and wood siding is typically vulnerable. And so, at least on an existing building, really providing that break between the ground and the start of your siding. Like, maybe it's very expensive to reclad your whole house, so maybe that's not what you're doing. But if you can, you know, flash 6 inches up from grade with non-combustible material, and just, you know, just try to give it a chance and be really good with your landscaping so that grasses aren't getting really long. You don't have debris piling up against your house. That's a really good, then embers hitting, you know, that interface of the ground and the side of your building, 6 inches up, it's a pretty big distance for an ember. And that really reduces the risk of your building catching fire. So, you know, typical vulnerabilities we see in existing buildings, wood siding, vinyl soffits, as I was talking about before. All you have to do is like put your garbage can next to your house. Your garbage can catches fire and then it burns through your soffit because your vinyl soffit doesn't resist anything. Any sort of wood shake roofs, they were sort of made illegal essentially in California in 2008 or earlier. We're getting there in other jurisdictions as well, but that's a major vulnerability for an existing building. For existing buildings, you have what you have now. It's expensive to mitigate everything. So landscaping is a major, major one that you can do for relatively low cost. Like, really reduce the load on the susceptible elements of your enclosure. And then Class A roof, protecting that interface at the base of wall and screening your vents with some sort of non-combustible, non-corroding mesh. So you might have bigger vents than, you know, would typically be allowed, or bigger vent spaces. But we figured out that if an ember makes it through an eighth of an inch mesh size, it doesn't have a lot of heat intensity and it's really difficult to actually ignite anything. And that's a little bit different than when the code first came out in California, which required a quarter inch mesh size. So there are definitely things you can do low cost, hitting the major vulnerabilities in the existing building stock.
Some wildfire prevention strategies are more passive in nature rather than actively applied.
You know, we like to focus on the passive fire protection measures because not everyone's going to have a pool in a lot of places. But if you do have a pool and, you know, there are certain pump systems, you know, we can't rely on the, you know, your tap water working for a source of water. But if we use certain types of pumps and hoses that and nozzles that you know allow us to fight the fire ourselves, or you know, even pre-wet, say a roof or wall system. We saw that in the Palisades fire, that a lot of houses that around them didn't survive. Theirs did, because they had a fire suppression system.
We did a forensic review of one of the big fires up in Canada. And there was this one building that had a sprinkler mounted right on top of the roof. And it was even just hooked up to the municipal system. And there was enough warning of this wildfire coming through that they turned their sprinkler on like a day and a half early, just soaked their house. This house was, if I could design a house that is like anti everything that we just talked about, anti every mitigation measure, like basically this house is a case study of what you shouldn't do, except they had a sprinkler on top and they survived, and houses next to them did not survive. Across the street, every house was burned down, but that house didn't burn down. An active system can be incredibly powerful, provided that it's working, right? Provided that it has enough water, provided that the power stays on. And there are workaround systems, you know, decoupled systems with gas generators and pumps and stuff like that. And then you're getting into bigger bucks. But for sure, active mitigation is, and it's something we haven't really touched on here, is a really a good option for some places, and especially for existing buildings where mitigating the whole building is just going to be cost prohibitive.
AIA, FEMA, IBHS, NFPA, local counties, and of course, RDH Building Science are great resources for homeowners, architects, and builders alike to learn more about wildfire resistance.
There's a lot of good resources out there locally here in Los Angeles and Pasadena and other, you know, places affected. The AIA, which is what Architects Institute of America, American Institute of Architecture, they're really leading the charge and providing a lot of education to their community of architects and, you know, by their way of homeowners. So their AIA LA and A Pasadena Foothill have a wealth of information related to the local rebuilding efforts here. And then beyond that, you know, there's a lot. Robin mentioned the IBHS. So, you know, the insurer wants to understand the risk and how to mitigate it. So there's a lot of testing and research that they've done to inform these guides that they're putting out. So the IBHS is a great one. There's the NFPA, which is, you know, U.S. Fire Protection. They have some wildfire-related stuff. And then actually, we just collaborated with Rockwool Insulation, mineral wool insulation manufacturer, to put out some technical details where you can actually, you know, pick up a roof-to-wall interface detail and, you know, point to which, you know, aspects need to be where and, you know, some solutions there.
Well, just in the U.S., there's FireWise. I think it's great. Just Google it. There's a huge amount of resources there, and it's really approachable. There's FEMA. FEMA has information sheets that are really good for people, sort of bite-sized kind of things that they can do for their houses. The Society for Fire Protection Engineers has a virtual wildland urban interface guide. I mean, there is a lot of information out there, and it's all good. Fire Safe Marin County, like a lot of like just county level and state level have their own guides as well. And then I think it's, you know, I think it's worth it to, if this is something of concern to you, you know, you want to learn more, your authority having jurisdiction, so your building department is probably going to have some information. Your municipality will probably have a community wildfire protection plan in place. And then your local fire department, just go down and check with them. They usually have a lot of information, or know where to get this information, or know what areas of your community are more at risk than others. Like they are the ones who are, you know, leading the charge a lot of the time on getting people protected. It's hard to put out a house fire. Nobody wants to do it if they can avoid it. So I think that's in the US. And in Canada, we have, there's a lot of other resources as well. Really similar, sort of like parallel resources. You, in the US, it's FireWise. In Canada, it's FireSmart. That's where most people go for the best information.
When we do publish a lot of what we do internally in terms of our research on RDH.com and our Learn Building Science platform. So there's your plug. And yeah, we've done a lot of work for external clients and we try to repurpose some of that and issue it ourselves.
Cam and Robin shed light on case studies where wildfire-resistant construction was beneficial. The recent Pacific Palisades fire in LA and the Camp Fire in Paradise of 2018.
Probably seen some of the news, you know, the news stream was pretty heavy after the disaster, and you know, they always pick out a couple homes similar with the Lahaina fires, and they say, oh, this is a miracle, how did these homes survive, or you know, everything else is devastated around it, but there's this one home that survived. It got so lucky to survive, but really it's not luck, and it's what we've been talking about today, that we know how to limit the risk and, you know, how to design and construct wildfire resistant home. So it's, you know, won't dive into too many details, but just reinforce that you see these homes that survive, and, you know, we worked on a few of them in the Palisades area. It can be done. And it's just a matter of educating yourself, maybe as an architect. And maybe if that education, you know, doesn't quite get to where you need to be, is involving experts and folks that know what they're doing related to this to design that home that's going to, you know, survive and hopefully stand the test of time.
Yeah, I think the big things to come out of the campfire in Paradise, it happened in 2018. At that time, it was, you know, the largest wildfire disaster. The things that came out of it are interesting because there were quite a number of houses that were built after 2008. And Cam already referenced this, but that's when the California Wildfire Code went into existence, basically. And so you could sort of mark the difference between houses that were built to the Wildfire Code and ones that were built previously. And there was a big difference in survival rates. It doesn't mean that every house survived. Far from it, actually. Only about 54% of the houses built after that survived. But a lot of them were actually caught fire by the house next to it. So it wasn't necessarily the wildfire that caught them on fire. But it was a stark difference. 18% before 2008, built before 2008, survived, and 54% built after 2008 survived. And that's, you know, getting rid of all the other variables like neighborhood location and stuff like that. Like really just looking at what mattered in terms of the property area itself and the building type. So that's big. It means that this really actually makes a difference. There's proof there. But they went further and they looked at what were the elements of the building that made it more vulnerable. What were the things that if you could make a list of like, this is the most important thing to do and then this, you know, it's a systems approach. So you don't want to do that too much. But if you're going to do that, what are the things that really increase the susceptibility to a building catching fire? And the first one was in this report called defensible space, but it's basically just the landscaping around your building. And then roofs were really important and decks were really important. And those, if you're hitting those, that's what came out of the campfire. And it was a really, so many structures burned, and it was a really sort of like interesting case study for designers to use to figure out what works and what doesn't, and are we doing the right things? And, you know, as a result, there were some changes made to how we approach wildfire resistant construction, but for the most part, it was validation that this really works.
As previously mentioned, Robin has experience as an active firefighter and underscores what to focus on most in grasping wildfire resistance.
I don't want to oversell myself here as a, you know, there's a lot of firefighters with so much more experience than I have. And, you know, when we're giving presentations, they're always the ones that come up and they're always the ones pushing for wildfire resistant construction. And the reason is when you're a firefighter, you know how hard it is to put a house out. It's fair when a house is fully involved, it is a very, very difficult thing to get under control again. And if you've seen that first, you know, up close and just the intensity of a big fire, most people don't really get a chance to see a house on fire or get to stand close to a house on fire. But when you have, it changes your perspective. You realize what an incredible power this is, and you just want to stop that from happening. And you know that you can. These tiny little things called embers, which are so easy actually to design for because they just don't have that much intensity. But that can start this huge chain reaction, because that's what a fire is. It's a chemical chain reaction. This huge chain reaction that is almost unstoppable at times. And so if I could get anything across to anybody, it's let's focus on not on really stopping those initial ignitions. Let's make the houses ember resistant at a minimum. That'll do so much for our built environment that's close to the wildlands. Anything in the wildland urban interface zone, ember resistant.
As wildfires become a constant concern in our warming world, their impact is increasingly felt in our daily lives. Yet, through community involvement, proactive prevention, and continued investment in research and resilient design, we can adapt to this new reality, building smarter, safer, and more consciously for the future. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what knowledge or resources Cam and Robin could share with an architect looking to better understand building enclosures.
I think it all comes back to the fundamentals and principles of understanding what are we trying to control with our building enclosure. And that comes back to, you know, our air, water, thermal. And we talked about the wildfire resistant piece. I think that's just another one to add on top of those control functions we're serving with the building enclosure. And if we get back to understanding what we're trying to control, you know, and can we draw those continuous lines of those said control layers, I think that's a really good foundational place to be as an architect. And then from there, it's understanding the systems that we use to provide those controls. Is it a, you know, beautiful bespoke window wall, curtain wall system, or is it, you know, our fiber cement with some exterior insulation to provide, you know, good thermal control and wildfire resistance? So it's really getting back to those fundamentals and asking why are we doing this? What functions is it serving? And not over designing that enclosure to do more than it needs.
Honestly, I think one of the most sustainable things we can do for a building is to make it beautiful. And that's not an engineering concept. It comes that I am actually paraphrasing an engineer, Joe Styrick from Building Science Corporation. But, you know, people care about something that is, you know, that they like to look at, that they feel pride in. And that's an architect's, that's the architect's role. They can make this building something that people care about and want to look after and keep up. And every time we tear down a building and build a new building, we are losing something on the sustainability side of the equation. My plug as an engineer would be, I don't think that beautiful has to be just, you know, without constraint. Like, I think we can work within a box and still design something that's extremely beautiful. And I like simplicity. But I think on Cam's point, like understanding the functions and then working with that. I'm guilty of this too with building my own house. I start with the outside. I just want something that looks really beautiful. And then I try and shoehorn in all the systems in the assemblies and stuff. And now I have like a 20-foot low slope valley that glaciates every winter. And I did that knowing full well that that was a bad idea, but it just looked so good. And I think if my plug is, let's not do that. We can make things, architects are, that's the point. They can make something incredibly functional and beautiful. We are a little bit more on the functional side of things, and we can sort of establish the constraints in which to work to create this beautiful object. Wildfire is just a constraint. All of the load management that we do are constraints. It doesn't mean that we have to change necessarily massively the way we build, or that our buildings need to look so incredibly different or just be ugly monstrosities. My plug is, yeah, function and form, but form is very important.
I truly enjoyed this conversation with Cam and Robin, and I feel pretty darn fortunate to work with such great, passionate professionals. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires a mark that you want to leave on this world.
Melding the personal with professional, you know, being an advocate and providing the technical know-how to battle climate change and look at how can we mitigate, and, you know, if we don't do so well on that, how do we be more resilient and adapt to the changing climate? So I think integrating that aspect into the built environment you know, this is something super important, and looking to the next generation is not important for us, but future generations. So I think it's that, and just, yeah, spreading happiness and joy in the world. And, you know, we're all humans at the end of the day. And you just talked about working as a team, like we can not just do it in a box. We need to collaborate and be innovative together to get to those solutions. So just one big happy family and community.
I think in my personal life, and it extends to my professional life, because I wouldn't do anything that I didn't think was the right thing to do, is for me, it's just lowering consumption. I think we have a consumption problem, and it stems all our other problems. And if we can lower our personal consumption, the way it translates professionally is energy consumption in buildings, material consumption of buildings. Like, let's not have to rebuild every 30 years. Let's make buildings last 400 years. There's no reason we can't design these buildings. It's almost like fast fashion in building form. Like, we expect a building just to like be torn down. I think that's ridiculous. I think it's very wasteful. So if I could contribute anything to the world, it's actually just to consume less personally and professionally.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.